Hello, everyone, and welcome to a new episode of the Philosophy Exchange podcast. My name is Ina, and I'm the host of today's episode. In today's podcast, we will focus on models in science and philosophy that aim to provide normative guidance to agents. As we will see, such normative models include models in decision theory and form epistemology that aim to tell us how we ought to act or what we ought to believe. We will hear about ways to understand, in particular, formal epistemology as modeling in analogy to how models are used in the sciences. We will also debate how descriptively false models can indeed have normative force for you and me as agents in the real world. And we will see how there's ample room for further research on how formal models can help normative inquiries. It is my pleasure now to introduce to you our three guests who are joining me today to discuss this interesting topic. Jo Rasus is a postdoctoral researcher at the Institute for Future Studies in Stockholm. Before going to Stockholm, Jo completed his PhD in philosophy at the London School of Economics and Political Science. His work spans across philosophy of science, epistemology, and decision theory. He's joining us today to discuss his paper on normative formal epistemology as modeling. We are also joined today by Lukas Beck. Lukas is about to defend his PhD at the Department of History and Philosophy of Science at the University of Cambridge. He is a philosopher of science, focusing in particular on the methodology of economics. We are also joined by Marcel Jamm, a PhD candidate at the Department of Philosophy at the Humboldt University in Berlin. Marcel's work focuses on the foundations of normativity and on topics that lie at the intersection of philosophy and the social sciences. Lukas and Marcel are here today to discuss their recent paper called Normative Models and Their Success.
My conversation with Joe, Lukas and Marcel will be split into two parts. In the first part, they will introduce their recent work on normative models, discuss the relevance of such models, and the core philosophical challenges of understanding how these work. In the second part, we will then discuss the limits of normative models, points of contention between Joe's and Lukas and Marcel's views, and which questions for further research they suggest.
So without further ado, welcome to Lukas and Marcel.
Thanks, Ina. Very happy to be here.
Great. So to start us off, I think it's a good idea if we talk a bit about what your recent papers have been on. Maybe Lukas and Marcel, could you start and please tell us a bit more about what normative models are and what your work on them has focused on?
Yeah, so quite generally speaking, our paper can be embedded in the philosophy of modeling, and we understand models as idealized representations of a certain aspect of reality, which is usually called the model's target system. Importantly, models are false representations of their targets, since they idealize and simplify them in various ways. This is usually done in order to have a less complex representation of its target system, so that we can better focus on and investigate the aspect of reality that we are interested in. Now, models can serve various different purposes, such as facilitating explanations, descriptions, and understanding. Lukas and I, we basically observe that there's a rich philosophical literature on the question of what makes models successful. But what philosophers usually discuss here is how models successfully meet certain descriptive aims, like facilitating explanations, predictions, or understanding. And we observe that there's a certain class of models, we call them normative models, that are taken to provide normative guidance to agents. And you find those models, for example, in decision theory, economics, and as Joe rightly highlights in his paper, also in formal epistemology. And the general idea is that these models can tell you what you should do in certain situations, right? They are not just about describing or representing a certain aspect of reality, but they're about telling you what you should do, how you should make certain decisions, or how you should update your beliefs if you get new evidence. And what is crucial to note here is that many scholars who do normative modeling seem to think that the model not only implies certain normative verdicts about what you should do, but also that the model does some kind of genuine justificatory normative work. It provides you with normative reasons to act as the model tells you to do. And Lukas and I, we also observe that philosophers have not yet investigated extensively the question of how models can successfully provide normative guidance to agents. And this is basically the question that Lukas and I address in the paper. And to just make clear why this question is particularly puzzling, it's crucial to see or to note the following about normative models. As the philosopher Mark Colyban has recently pointed out, normative models usually involve two kinds of idealizations, normative and descriptive idealizations. And a normative idealization kind of picks out a fact about how an agent should behave or how her attitudes should look like. So normative idealizations are essentially those which the agent has kind of normative reason to live up to anyway, independently of being part of this specific model. For instance, models based on expected utility theory, for short EUT models, assume that you have kind of transitive preferences, and it's commonplace to think that you just have reason to have transitive preferences, irrespective of whether this assumption figures in a normative model. And now, crucially, on the other hand, there are also descriptive idealizations figuring in normative models, and they are just merely false factual statements about the model's target, and you do not have any kind of reason or model-independent reason to satisfy them. For instance, your T models assume that agents have continuous preferences, which means that preferences operate on an implausibly fine-grained level. This assumption kind of clearly misrepresents how we are, and we do not seem to have a normative reason to have such continuous preferences. This assumption is usually just invoked to afford us with mathematical convenience. Now, and this is the key to our paper, it is especially the presence of descriptive idealizations that make it hard to see how normative models can successfully provide normative guidance to agents. The question arises, how can it be that a false representation of you, which is the model's target, how can this false representation be normatively relevant to you in the sense of successfully telling you what to do and thereby to also provide you with a normative reason to follow the model's verdicts?
All right. And in light of what Marcel has just said, what we then basically try to do in the paper is to offer an invitation for the debate about the features in virtue of which normative models can successfully exert these guidance function. And so towards this aim, we basically introduce and discuss two potential accounts of their success conditions. And then according to the first account, normative models work in a way that's pretty analogous to normative arguments. So the basic idea here is that also normative arguments involve these two types of premises, namely normative premises, for which we need some form of normative justification, and also descriptive premises, for which we need some form of support for their veridicality. And then the basic idea in the case of a normative argument is that if you have both types of support for the respective premises, then also the conclusion of the argument exerts some form of normative guidance on us, or at least it should do so. And now what the idea of this first account is basically that there's nothing special to see when it comes to normative models. They also involve two types of idealizations, like Marcel has pointed out. And then the idea is, well, for the normative idealizations, we simply need normative justification. And for the descriptive idealizations, we need some support for their verticality. However, in the paper, we make clear that we are pretty skeptical of this story. And the main reason is that we think that descriptive idealizations in normative models are not usually having this kind of veridical justification. So in other words, we think that it's not usually true that those idealizations are true or approximately true in any interesting sense of the term. And admittedly, in the paper, we do not say that our arguments that kind of are aimed at rejecting this story are conclusive. And we also highlight the fact that there might be another story of how normative models exert normative guidance that crucially grounds this ability in their assumption, in their assumptions. However, we do not really see how such a story could look like. And so towards the end of the paper, we turn to a completely different account. And this account basically assumes that normative models exert normative guidance in virtue of extending it. So the rough idea behind this account is imagine you're in a situation where you already have a class of justified normative verdicts, and now you find a sparse set of assumption that allow you to build a model that captures those already justified normative verdicts, then we say that you thereby also identify a certain pattern in those normative verdicts. And now if you realize that also another normative verdict about which you have so far been unsure falls within the pattern that is identified by the normative model, then you also gain some justification for this novel verdict. So thereby we say the model extends justification from the previous class of verdicts to this novel verdict. And our tentative conclusion then in the paper is basically that the second story seems more promising for explaining how normative models exert normative guidance, because it basically circumvents all the problems that descriptive idealizations would introduce.
Thank you so much, Lucas and Marcel, for that very nice summary of your very interesting work. Before we dive into the discussion, I would like to give Joe the chance to also tell us a bit more about his views concerning normative models, and in particular, his paper, which is, amongst other things, arguing that we should understand at least normative formal epistemology as an exercise of modeling. So, Joe, do you want to tell us a bit more about that?
Sure, I'd be happy to. So our papers, as you mentioned, I guess, are slightly different in that my aim primarily was to convince philosophers that they are modelers too. So my paper is also a philosophy of science paper, but the kind of science I'm interested in is this bit of philosophy, if you like. So the reason it's necessary to try and convince philosophers that they're doing modeling is partly just that the term comes from science, that we think of scientists as modelers, that we think of modeling as a kind of descriptive exercise. And so this whole field, the discussion I'm having and the discussion that Lucas and Marcel is having, is kind of underexplored because there hasn't been enough recognition that models can also be normative. So my focus in the paper you mentioned is really on Bayesianism. So which in philosophy is a program where we talk about agents having probabilistic beliefs, and we discuss what conditions these beliefs ought to satisfy in order to count as rational. I'm interested more broadly in normative formal epistemology. So any epistemology that uses mathematics, that's what makes it formal, and is normative, so attempts to give evaluative criteria or prescriptions, things that people ought to do in order typically to be rational. So what I do is I analyze how philosophers in epistemology who do this work operate, and I argue that we should understand their work as modeling. Now, I'm not doing empirical work. I'm not surveying all of philosophers. Instead, I'm providing what's called a rational reconstruction of the method of normative formal epistemology. And the way this kind of reconstruction works is that there is a quasi-descriptive part where you look at what is happening and you sort of prepare it, you describe it in a way that outlines its logic and makes it sound as good as possible. You try to present how it would best function. And then there's a sort of critical part where you offer suggestions for how it could be improved. So when I do that, I look at normative formal epistemology and reconstruct it in a way that shows that it has characteristic features of modeling. And in fact, they're essentially the features that we've just been hearing about. Specifically, the use of idealization, I think, is a really core feature of this kind of work. But also the fact that it is, in some sense, a kind of indirect inquiry. So what we do is, rather than studying the phenomena directly, rather than talking about people's beliefs in particular cases in the way that perhaps non-formal epistemologists will do, formal epistemologists will often describe this object, a kind of abstract mathematical object, the thing that I'm calling the model, and then they will study that thing as a kind of proxy for the phenomena that we're interested in, the epistemic phenomena of patterns of belief and so on. So those two criteria, idealization and this kind of indirect inquiry, are core characteristics that lead me to propose that we should regard this as modeling. But so far, that's just a thing we could do. So it looks like modeling. So why should we regard it as modeling? My argument is basically that the way traditionally philosophers regard their work doesn't fit well with this kind of formal epistemology. That if we take formal epistemologists to be trying to construct what I call theories, they're not doing very well. So traditional epistemology has often taken itself to be looking for necessary conditions, things that are true always and everywhere, analyses of concepts like knowledge. But formal epistemology, because of its reliance on idealizations, just can't be thought of as doing that. Or if we do think of it as doing that, it's just doing badly, because it often makes claims or involves statements that we know are false. What are those? They're exactly the idealizations we've been talking about. So on a view in which this is just standard philosophy, attempting to come up with analyses, necessary and sufficient conditions, definitions that hold at all times, things that are full and complete accounts, it isn't going to be doing very well. It makes much more sense to view this whole exercise as an exercise in modeling. And now the question is, can it be modeling? Because it's normative. And so here's the common ground between our papers. We're interested in what it means for a model to be normative, how one could do normative modeling. In Lucas and Marcel's case, the focus is on success, how one could successfully generate normative guidance from a model. I'm also interested in that, but I'm interested in part in just giving an account of what it would even mean for a model to be normative, because I'm trying to convince philosophers that this is a thing that is possible, whereas I think Lucas and Marcel are just starting with what I think also is the clear fact that these models in economics say exist and they are normative. So those are some similarities and differences. I think there's a lot of overlap. But my goal really is to convince philosophers to adopt this terminology, to call themselves modelers, and to change some of how they work, because modelers have techniques and tools for managing these useful falsehoods, dealing with the idealizations and understanding how they impact the results that your model generates is really kind of core to the practice of modeling. And as philosophers don't typically think of themselves as modelers, these are perhaps not techniques that we're trained in or that we are used to thinking about. And so part of my paper's conclusion is to advocate for new techniques and new styles of training graduate students, new ways of thinking about our goals as philosophers.
Thank you so much, Joe, for that very, very concise summary of your work, of a very interesting paper. I suppose to get us started, I suggest one thing we could do is to focus on this world of idealizations. And I would just put out there one view that one might have, and that a sense you both disagree with. And that's sort of this view that you could think about a normative model, say in decision theory, an expected utility model, as essentially modeling not any real world choice or any real world agent, but rather modeling an ideal, right? And in that sense, descriptive idealizations might not be really idealizations because you're not idealizing away from the real world agent, right? So if you're modeling the ideal agent, what Lucas or Marcelo, it was, I think, called a descriptive idealization might not be so much of a problem. So could either of you maybe find out what's wrong with that view? Or why should we not just say that such normative models model ideals?
Yeah, so this is also a possible view on normative models that we describe and discuss shortly in the paper. So to reiterate the idea is that, well, what a model does is, it's, or how we should understand a normative model is to be a, actually be a descriptive model of a certain normative ideal. Right. So in the case of formal epistemology, you could think that the model is a descriptive model of the ideal Bayesian updater, or in decision theory or economics, it's a descriptive model of the perfect utility maximizer, right? And basically, Lucas and I, we don't have any particular objection against that idea. But the problem that we see in this possibility is that we don't really see how this could explain that models do any kind of genuine normative work in and of themselves, right? So if you assume that, for example, you just have reason to be the perfect utility maximizer, right? Then, as it were, all the normative facts are already settled, right? Then you have a kind of independent justification, independent normative justification, perhaps due to normative theorizing with the method of reflective equilibrium, that you know you should just be the perfect utility maximizer. And the model could then be a means to kind of explore what it means to be a perfect expected utility maximizer and to draw some more kind of specific conclusions, but the normative content of those do not really go beyond the content that you have already established independently of the model. So to put it in a nutshell, we don't have any objection against that. It's just that with this description of what normative models are all about, we would not have found a way to validate the claim that we find modelers usually making, that normative models do any kind of genuine normative work and that they do some, you know, justificatory normative work and provide you with normative reasons to act in their accordance, because all of that would already be settled quite independently of the model.
So maybe just one brief addition to what Marcel has just said. So in the paper, we try to make this more vivid via the following analogy. So we have this example of the ideal Machiavellian prince, right? So there the idea is basically Machiavelli gives you this description of the ideal prince, but just in virtue of offering you this description, he hasn't really given you a reason to be this prince, right? So you would need some additional normative justification that then tells you, look, here's the reason for why you should be this prince. And so in analogy to this, you know, if it's just a description, then the model itself doesn't do any genuine normative work. And we, I think, just try to take the idea, serious, that more is going on when we do normative modeling than just describing certain ideal types of agents.
I agree with all of that. And I think that there is some similarity here with scientific cases. We could imagine a case where we have a model of two perfect spheres in empty space and they're orbiting, one is orbiting the other. This could be useful, I suppose, if we just considered it to be a descriptive model of ideal spheres in empty space. Perhaps it could help one to work out how to use Newtonian gravity, but its use would be limited. Models get interesting and do this valuable work in science when they're used to make inferences about the real world. And taking those perfect spheres in empty space to stand for the Earth and the Sun, and then using it as an idealized model of the Earth-Sun orbital system is, it turns out, a highly successful method for making inferences about that real system, so long as one adopts the methods of idealized modeling. And so I think that it's unnecessary to make this kind of move. And in fact, it seems more respectful of the way that philosophers are in fact using them to continue the analogy with science into philosophy. It seems that we intend to describe agents. We put in details about particular choices, particular beliefs that they have. It's in virtue of the similarities between real agents and the ideal agents that it seems that these models are interesting. And so I think the commonalities just really stand out to me, that it seems we are doing this very similar thing to science. It works well in science. And so it seems to me to be unnecessary to come up with an entirely separate account, which is only an account of normative models as they would be used in philosophy, when we can get an account of all of the behavior and the use of them by unifying the account of normative models and scientific models in the way that I think both of us are trying to do, by pointing out the similarities, the descriptive idealizations, the representation relations, and so on.
Very interesting. One of the reasons why I brought up this sort of provocative question is that I've been thinking a bit about what someone would say who doesn't like the use of formal methods, particularly in philosophy. And of course, there are people who don't and who criticize that, criticize the whole idea of formal epistemology, for instance, and think that that's just not good epistemology. And so I've been thinking about, you know, what you might want to respond to that from the perspective of the role of normative models in something like formal epistemology. So, and in particular, if there's something to be said there in analogy to the epistemic role of models in science, instead of a justificatory argument for using models in philosophy that comes out of this analogy. So what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I've thought a lot about this, in part because my target is philosophers and I'm interested in convincing epistemologists and more recently ethicists to regard their own work as involving modeling. I recognize the kind of person you're identifying. There are people who dislike formal work because they think of it as being very disconnected from the real topics that they're interested in. It's often described as too abstract and as involving these obvious falsehoods, the idealizations. And those are meant to make it in some way besides the point or disconnected from the reality of the phenomena we're investigating. What I think is interesting about describing this formal work as modeling is precisely that it helps to understand why people would be interested in doing it and why it can be useful despite containing these falsehoods. Because if what we had was a highly abstract formal system which contained many falsehoods, and we stopped the description there, it would indeed be a bit curious as an exercise. It would be unclear why anyone would want to do this mathematics instead of just getting down to the business of doing epistemology. But once we understand that modeling is a kind of highly successful method in science, in which scientists are able to manage these idealizations and manage the connection between the target that they're modeling and this highly abstracted mathematical apparatus, and generate really interesting results, then we can discover or convince ourselves that there is potential in this method in something like philosophy. But it doesn't come for free. It requires paying careful attention to those idealizations, worrying about potential artifacts in the model, where an artifact is something that emerges because of the way you've built the model. So it's some feature or property of the model, but it's just a feature or property that's there because of how you set things up, the mathematics you chose to use, or some assumption that you made that is not normatively justified and is not a well-controlled idealization. And those can be misleading. An artifact can imply something about the real world that you don't want to infer. So there are all these techniques for how to do modeling well that are required, that people need to adopt. But I think once you have this whole picture, how it's meant to work, what you have to do it well, you understand how modeling functions in a kind of healthy environment as it does in many sciences, then it shouldn't challenge people. They don't have to do modeling, not everyone has to do modeling, but it should be clearer what its purpose is and why someone might want to do modeling.
I think then maybe I think there's a lot of disagreement between us and Joe in the first place. So maybe to point out potentially some of the spots where we disagree. Modeling is a very successful methodology in science. But I mean, I think there are not only these, you know, skeptics when it comes to ethics or epistemology, but there's, I think, also a lot of skepticism against modeling as a methodology in the sciences. And so I think what we tried then to do in our paper is, especially with the second account that I've tried to discuss, is to tell maybe a more minimal story about normative modeling. So a story that, you know, also works for people who are highly skeptical of this idea of involving descriptive idealizations. So these are people who probably say, yeah, but I think, you know, this is just a false assumption. And it's also not in any case, in any way similar or close enough to the truth. So how can this model provide me with normative guidance? So I think part of the intention of our second account was then basically to address exactly this kind of skeptic and say, hey, if you are unhappy with this picture, and I mean, we think there are also you know, good reason for maybe taking this stance in the first place, then here's this alternative extending story.
Yeah, and maybe one thing to add to this. So what Lucas just said is that, you know, it's puzzling how you can have descriptive idealizations, and this device, the model that contains these descriptive idealizations, kind of gives you something that is of normative relevance to you. And what is kind of important to highlight is that this kind of stands in very stark contrast with how meta-ethicists usually conceive of their work, right? Usually the method in ethics, or how meta-ethicists conceive of it, is that what provides you with normative justification are just normative arguments. And in normative arguments, you have descriptive premises that are just true, right? They require veridical justification, and that's it. And so I think what both Joe's and our paper is kind of getting at, also from a like bigger picture perspective, is that both in the methodology of sciences, but also in the methodology of ethics, perhaps, we could and should be more open to certain methods that work perhaps a little differently how meta-ethicists usually kind of conceive of their methodological toolkit, and also be more open to such modeling exercises, especially given that, you know, a lot of work in ethics also seems to rely on kind of idealized representations, if you think about population ethics and things like that. So it's a very interesting kind of methodological issue to explore here. I think both of our papers point out kind of certain perspectives that one could take more seriously, I guess.
I just want to add one thing, which is I think there's different things that models could be used for, and the role that they play in a normative discipline, or more broadly within normative inquiry, need not be the kind of role that Lucas and Marcel are investigating. So their paper is about successfully providing normative justification, and they really zoom in on this question of whether or not the fact that a model says something can itself provide you with normative justification, as I understand it. But I'm open to all kinds of uses of models in normative disciplines. They could be used to work out consequences of a theory, to test the compatibility of various assumptions. They are in fact used to generate normative claims that are direct claims of the sort that are in this paper on the success of normative models. And so that's definitely one thing that I think it's interesting to think about. But they could play a role which is different from that too. They could be used to come up with hypotheses. They could be used to test out ideas and isolate particular aspects of a theoretical account to really zoom in on and study. So even if we all fail in our attempt to provide normative justification, that still wouldn't mean that there was no role for modeling in normative inquiry, because they could provide non-justificatory value to normative inquirers and to philosophers who do this kind of work.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I hope I can speak for the two of us here, but I think we completely agree with this more like pluralist stance about, you know, the aims of normative models. I guess we would just say that it's, you know, nonetheless important to provide a detailed account of how they can meet, you know, this one particular aim, which is, you know, normative justification or normative guidance.
Great. Thank you for the great discussion thus far. As mentioned before, this podcast consists of two parts. In the first part, we now discussed Lucas, Marcel's and Joe's recent papers and the philosophical challenges normative models pose. In the next part, we will continue our conversation, focusing on disagreements between Lucas, Marcel's and Joe's views, limits of normative models, and questions for further research. I hope this podcast sparked your interest to tune in for the next part.